All right, everyone. This is my contribution to BitreichCon 2020, and it's titled Energy Efficient Programming in Science. So I'm pretty new to the Bitreich ISC channel, so I thought I'd introduce myself at this opportunity. So I'm a 33-year-old Dane, and at present I'm part-time employed as a postdoc at Stanford University in the US, and I'm also part-time employed as a lecturer at Aarhus University in Denmark. And previously I've worked at a range of US and Danish research institutions, and what I'm presenting here is really an experience and an opinion that I've gathered from this career. My academic interests lie within ice sheets and glaciers and climates, and in particular, learning how sensitive these different natural settings are to changes in forcing. I'm also interested in earthquake and landslide physics, because it would be wonderful if we would improve our tools so we could predict some of these. My methods typically my research typically uses various numerical models in order to understand these different natural systems. So I do numerical modeling, and just as a brief overview, there are many types of numerical models. And in science and climate research, you have two main types of models. The first are n-body types of simulations, which are where you have discrete entities floating around and interacting. That could be planetary debris that collides and produce planetoids. It could be icebergs that float around on the ocean surface. And it could be sediment grains that are important for soil and rock mechanics. So that's one type of numerical simulation. Another type are CFD models, computational fluid dynamics, which simulate various fluid flows. So these could be liquids, such as water and various other liquids such as lava and so on. It could also be air. So CFD is used for simulating aerodynamics in industry and academia. And it's also used for predicting weather and climates in the future. And common for all of these models is that you typically split your domain up into small and manageable chunks, because it's much easier to operate on a small cell volume rather than trying to resolve the whole Earth at once. So it's very common to discretize your domain into smaller volumes. The general workflow for a scientist looks something like this. So first of all, you would come up with some kind of concept that you want to translate into a numerical simulation. Maybe you come up with a better way of simulating cloud formation. So the first step is that you write down a system of equations on paper or whatever. And the second step is that you then figure out how you actually numerically solve this system of equations from the first step. The third step is that you then prototype your numerical solution in typically a high-level language. And the fourth step is that you then take your prototype and port it to a low-level language so you can actually employ it on high-performance computing clusters, because they all run C and Fortran and the like. So for most scientists, we are pretty good at the first three steps, and we get trained in how to do that, but we don't get any training whatsoever in programming in low-level languages. So for most people, the first three are okay, but the fourth is really a big pain point. So here's a brief example of what numerical modeling could look like. The common task is that you want to solve a system of equations, which are typically partial differential equations, or PDEs, and you want to predict how this system changes over time. For instance, that could be starting with the present day weather, and you're interested in seeing what the weather would be like tomorrow or at a later point in time. So in your computer program, you typically increase time and simulate the transient evolution. And examples of PDEs are the basic conservation laws, which are the conservation of mass, the conservation of momentum, and the conservation of enthalpy, which is heat. So here, just a very high-level example. This is the heat diffusion equation through a homogeneous medium. So it says that the change in temperature, and temperature is capital T here, the change in temperature over time is given by the thermal diffusivity of the material, which is lowercase k. And the thermal diffusivity is a number which is high for something that is well at transporting heat, such as a metal, or low for something which is bad at transporting heat, like a styrofoam or some other insulating material. And the thermal diffusivity is multiplied by the spatial variation in temperature, which is this symbol. It's called the Laplacian operator of the temperature field. So if you, over a distance, have a large gradient in temperature, then you are likely to have a large flow through that distance. So as I mentioned, you typically have a domain where you want to resolve the temperature inside for this application. So here we have this 1D rod of some kind of material. The next step is then to subdivide your domain into little cells. Here we have 7 cells, each with a single value for temperature. So the temperature is no longer a continuous function, but it's a discrete and finite number of values within this medium. So in the high-level languages, it's very easy and very convenient to actually solve these systems of equations. In MATLAB, for instance, and Python and Julia, it's really just a one-liner. Once you've set up your boundary conditions and your initial conditions and your systems of equations, then it's really just a one-liner. And that makes it very easy for scientists and people without explicit programming training to actually do these kinds of computations. In lower level languages, you have to do, of course, a lot more work. So in this example, we want to keep the temperature constant at the left and the right outermost cells. So imagine that we have this body of material with heat propagating through it, and we have the states at an initial point of time t. We then want to calculate the temperature at a later point in time, which would then be t plus dt. The Laplacian operator in the heat diffusion equation says that the temperatures are not only dependent on the space that you are calculating, but also in the surrounding cells. So for that reason, the temperature for t2 at the time step t plus dt will be a function of t1, t2, and t3. With the simplest way of actually solving these systems of equations are something called explicit central finite differences. And the outer for loop here is the time loop that I previously mentioned. So we are stepping through simulation time with this code snippet. And for each time step, we loop through the inner cells within this domain, and we multiply the thermal diffusivity, which was lowercase k, with the Laplacian operator, which has the form ti plus 1 minus 2 times t of I, and plus ti minus 1, divided by the cell size squared. So it's a really easy operation, actually, if you break it down. And after the update, you swap the pointers, so you now have the new solution as your current solution. The problem with this explicit solution is that your heat signal cannot propagate more than one cell per time step. So in this case, your final state will be dependent on the time step size. So in order to overcome that, you actually introduce another loop within each time step, which is the do while loop here. So here you keep on finding a solution within every time step until the solution values do not change significantly anymore. So you compare the new to the previous solution and calculate the difference between the two. And once the difference becomes neglectable, you stop the do while loop and you're happy with the solution for that time step. And in this case, the final time step will, or the final solution will not depend on the time step length. So as you can see, these are not really one-liners anymore, and there are many other ways of solving these equation systems which are much more complicated than these finite differences. Just a quick overview of what these HPC platforms are designed like. You all know that CPU clock frequency has pretty much stagnated, so unfortunately it's not any more possible just to sit around and wait for a faster processor to solve your unthreaded code. So instead, you need to get performance through massively parallel deployments. And at present, there are a few standards on how to do that. One standard is MPI, which is the message passing interface, which is a standard for network communication between machines. It can also be used for parallelizing within a single machine and distributing workload between the CPU cores, but it's better at communicating between different devices. There's another parallelization standard called OpenMP, which is designed for parallelizing between cores on a single computer, but it has no network communication. So in a lot of cases, people actually combine MPI and OpenMP in order to get the highest performance. A different trend is general purpose GPU computing. That's, for instance, OpenCL or NVIDIA's CUDA. And the idea here is that you take some kind of accelerator units, which is very good at performing parallel floating point operations, and you plug that into your individual compute nodes and get performance in that way. I have experience with the National Oceanic and Atmosphere Administration cluster called Gaia, which is used for climate and weather forecasting in the US. It consists of two Cray XC40 units running something called the Cray Linux environments. The cluster consists of a bit more than 4,000 nodes, each with around 36 cores and 64 gigabytes of memory. These nodes are interconnected by InfiniBand, which is much quicker than normal Ethernet and really optimal for MPI communication. So this system has a total of 200 terabytes of memory, 32 petabytes of SSD storage, and a practical peak performance of 5.25 petaflops. And this system uses the power equivalent of a small US city. So as I previously mentioned, the scientists, which are not really programmers, are struggling in how to port the high-level numerical programming programs to lower-level languages so they can actually deploy them on these HPC systems. So you, in the high-level languages, have the luxury of using all kinds of library calls, which make life easy, but you now have to deal with a low level of abstraction, and your code is no longer interpreted, but it's compiled and it's running in a massively parallel fashion. So again and again, I see a suggestion for how to work around this issue. And people are proposing to port interpreted high-level languages, such as MATLAB, such as Python and Julia, to HPC platforms. And that's really the essence of this talk, and that's something I really think is a suboptimal solution to this problem. Because with every single instance launch of Python, of Julia, and of MATLAB, you have a high computational overhead. At the same time, you might have 4,000 machines that all experience this high computational overhead. So as a result, you get reduced performance and reduced energy efficiency because you spend more time computing the solutions and and you simply have a lower performance. In my opinion, there is a much better way of how to deal with this kind of workflow. So again, steps one and two are the same. You come up with a system of equations and a way of solving this system of equations. I am a strong proponent of doing the step three prototyping in low-level languages. So instead of using these luxury proprietary garbage programs such as MATLAB, you should use something like C or Fortran or whatever you prefer to do your prototyping during step three. Because then the barrier between step three and four is much, much lower. You simply have to maybe do some optimization and sprinkle some MPI parallelization on top of your low-level prototype, and then you are pretty much good to go. So finally, I want to give you an example of a numerical simulation from my own research. And as I mentioned, I'm interested in glaciology, which is involving the study and research on glaciers and ice sheets in the Earth system. So in this sketch, you see grounded ice on the left. This could be the interior of the Antarctic ice sheet, and it's flowing towards the ocean with roughly velocities of 1 kilometer per year. And these relatively rapid ice flows of 1 kilometer per year are facilitated because the ice flows on basal sediments, and those are old marine deposits, clays and sands and the like that are very mechanically weak. And once the ice reaches the ocean, it reaches buoyancy because ice is lighter than water, and it starts to float on top in what we call an ice shelf. So here you have many different boundaries. You have boundaries between ice and sediment, you have boundaries between ice and ocean, and ice and atmosphere. And you want to be able to simulate all of these different systems in order to predict evolution in 100 years in the future. So the flow of the ice over the sediment is really crucial here because the sediments are lubricating the ice flow because they're weak. And for that reason, the sediments are responsible for 90% of the Antarctic ice sheet mass movement. So I did some simulations on the sediment ice physics, and during my PhD, I developed this program called Sphere, which was my perhaps first major software development undertaking. And then I had a different approach on how to tackle these kinds of problems in a technical sense. So I wrote this in C++. I used NVIDIA C to simulate this in a massively parallel fashion. It's built with CMake. I use Python for setting up each experiment and for doing post-processing on the results. And I also use ParaView for visualizing the model output. And ParaView is a 3D interactive rendering programming. The program is massively parallel because of the GPU implementation. It has insanely detailed physics. So here it's actually simulating how the seismic waves propagate through the material and how each single grain of sand would rotate as a function of that. It's also 2,000 lines of code, and the results for my first paper with this program took 3 months to compute on a very high-end modern GPU with almost 3,000 cores. It's not because there is in the algorithm a lot of bloat, but it's simply a very computationally intensive problem to compute. But after using this program and getting the results that I needed, I started to realize what kinds of physics that are important and what I could throw out, what I could get rid of. And I was able to simplify the physics and the numerics and the algorithm in general. So recently I wrote another program, which is maybe a bit more elegant than my previous one. It's written in C99, uses makefiles and gnuplot, so very simple. It's also not parallel. And it has, yeah, these aforementioned very simple physics and a smaller code base also. And with this code, I was able to reproduce my previous examples in just 70 milliseconds on my old potato laptop from 2012. So first I had to do some very, very complex stuff in order to understand what was necessary, and then I could strip that away and actually just get on with the bare minimum. So of course the latter solution is much more portable, and the simple program is something I can plug into the large scale climate simulations, and it's very portable in its design. So I'm very happy with that. So just to sum up, for numerical simulations, you have high level languages, which are easy to use for the scientists, and you can produce results quickly and write a paper and get on with it. However, you are not able to use your code to proceed to employing in HPC systems, because that requires low-level programming. On the other hand, low-level languages require low-level skills, but if you do your prototyping in these low languages, you also develop these low-level programming skills along the way. You also save electrical energy because it takes much less time to actually produce your results. And when you want to go ahead and port your code to HPC, you just need to worry about parallelization and then you're good to go. So finally, thanks to Christoph and thanks to anyone on Bitreich, the ISC channel and everyone there. I've certainly learned a lot during my time there and I've had a lot of fun. So yeah, that's been great. I'm looking forward to whatever in the future. All right, let's see if there are some questions. Does climate change exist? Yeah, some of us believe that's actually the case, but other people disagree. But the way to handle that is just to have a sober scientific discussion, and then perhaps you can reach a consensus. Evil Bob, how do you check for correctness in the equations versus the simulation, especially when a simulation takes many months? Yeah, that's a good question. And of course, a lot of the time that you spend before being able to do the actual simulations is done on verifying whether your code is actually correct. And time again, you find out this is not the case. So the way to do it is to simulate very simple test cases during your model development. For instance, this could be something where you have a clear mathematical solution for what is correct. You then design a numerical simulation to exactly mimic that setup, and if the two match, then you have some level of confidence that your code is doing the right thing. But for instance, in some of these big climate codes, it took quite a while to make the Earth stop cooling just from itself, and that was because there was a floating point error in some of the code, which simply skewed the results as simulation time proceeded. So yeah, verifying your code is absolutely essential. And many people also intercompare different models if you don't have a mathematical solution to benchmark against. Yeah, assert everywhere, exactly. Any more questions? I can just scroll through the ISC log. I wonder if they use systemd. I actually don't know much about this Cray Linux environment. It's of course some kind of proprietary thing. Yeah, so what are the low-level languages? C, Assembler, something like that. It depends. This is SkinGraph asking the question. The low-level languages can be C, they can also be Fortran. And I'm not a particular fan of Fortran, but it has been there since the beginning. So the first weather forecasting in the 60s and so on was done in Fortran. And every time you come up with better modeling algorithms and so on, you would typically develop on what you already have. So that means that there is a huge code legacy within climate modeling, and some of these climate models have millions of lines of code. So of course it would be nice to translate the Fortran into maybe C or something like that, but nobody wants to port millions of lines of Fortran and do all the debugging that is accompanied with such a task. Okay, 20H, do you run unit tests on every build? That depends on the person. I typically do it with Git hooks, where I simply have a test suite to check if I didn't break anything with my code changes. And I believe there was a talk maybe last year at BitreichCon, which I saw in the archive, which talked about different test types. And the easiest test type is simply to check if you have exact reproduction in your floating point output. So if you have some differing output from your simulation, then you probably screwed something up. But of course, on a final level, you could also do unit testing of the individual functions, and that just takes more work. But it's kind of what you decide to do. Joshua asked, did these experiences convince some colleagues to drop their large, difficult tool set? Yeah, well, many people actually give up on it because it's so difficult to port the code for many people that they simply are happy with their prototypes, which are running in MATLAB on their desktop machines. And maybe just 5% of all those findings actually trickle down into the large models. So it's a bit of a shame that it's such a struggle for people. And I would be really pleased if there was made a bigger effort to actually teach people in low-level programming at the universities and not kind of funnel them into a world of MATLAB where they end up learning nothing and having no control and insight into the numerical algorithms. More C, exactly. Write in C, always. Yeah, exactly. We need more C math developers. 20H asks, have you tried scaling SPSS to the clusters? What is SPSS? I have no idea. IBM statistics application. Aha. Yeah, so in terms of numerical modeling, there's a big divide. There's the people that produce numbers, which are the people that use numerical simulations, such as the one I described here. And there you typically use very few statistics. On the other side, there are people that read numbers and do statistics on them. So on my side of the fence, we use very few statistics because we produce numbers. We don't look at them. Excel for medicine students. Sounds awesome. All right, good. I'll leave the stream. Thank you very much for your attention, and thank you for the nice questions. See you later.